number of stories on federalnewsradio.com relating to this report that is being submitted, already submitted by Army General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, writing about the situation in Afghanistan. Joining me to talk about this report, Dr. James Carafano, Deputy Director of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's the author of several books, including Private Sector, Public Wars, Contracting in Combat, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Future Conflicts. And Dr. Carafano, thank you for joining me again to talk about it. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
What did you what do you see in what General McChrystal is writing about what is happening in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, in a sense, there's kind of no news there. I mean, he's just confirming what a lot of experts who have been over there have said. A lot of it, actually, the combat reporting has been similar. What he's saying is, look, you know, we can't win with the current strategy we have. And here's the simple reason why is after we defeated the Taliban and we pushed them out of the country and Al-Qaeda, they went into Pakistan. And in a sense, the Pakistanis cut a deal with the Pakistan Taliban to host both the Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And then what they did is essentially they rebuilt their capabilities. They part of the money is drug money, but a big chunk of the money is just money that Al-Qaeda has collected from around the world. And they rearmed, they refit, and now they're back. And the problem was is we were so committed in Iraq, the Taliban were able to, since, rebuild their capabilities before we rebuilt the capabilities of the Afghan military and police and government to push back at them. We brought NATO in. NATO wasn't a big help. Some of their troops in NATO are great. Don't get me wrong. The Canadians are awesome. The Danes are awesome. Some of the other countries have very significant caveats that don't really allow new combat operations. They haven't been very effective really at civil society programs. So that's what's got us where we are today. Nobody's really surprised at that. A lot of things we did weren't working. Drug eradication wasn't working. You know, trying to stop them at the border to keep them from coming across didn't working. It's too much border. Border's too big. It's too difficult to control. You know, pinging and taking out leaders in Pakistan just wasn't enough. So the strategy just wasn't working, and we needed a different one. So he's identified the problem. He said there's not a quick and easy solution. That, you know, even if we do this right, we're talking about several years. And now we're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, which was, what does he need for additional resources to turn the tide?
I want to talk about that resource issue because that's at the crux of what our audience is interested in. Who's going to provide those resources and what more specifically do you think they might be? But I want to touch on this border issue for a minute because this has been the thing that people have attributed to whatever success we're having at handing things off in Iraq to the fact that the Iraq-Iran border has become a little bit more secure and there aren't the waves of people coming in from Iran into Iraq.
Yeah, well, there's two problems. One is geography is different. You know, one of the reasons why the Iraq-Iran war, people remember back in when Iraq and Iran were war with each other, why that war went on so time is those borders aren't necessarily the easiest to cross, right? In contrast, the Afghan-Pakistan border is long, it's open, it's difficult, it's rugged. Populations, the Pashtun, which is the major ethnic group of which a lot of the Taliban are members, that Pashtun population is actually spread across both countries. So it's an impossible border to control. The much better analogy is near North Vietnam and South Vietnam, when South Vietnam was bordered by Cambodia, Laos, and North Vietnam, and couldn't control any of those borders.
Is it fair to call that Pashtun population almost its own country without a border?
Well, it's a people with two countries, and you know, it's not unusual actually. There's lots of places around the world where very, very large ethnic groups, including familial ties, span geographical borders because that's the way the Europeans, you know, set things up. There are places like that in Africa, places like that in Central Asia. But in a sense, they are distinct groups. I mean, there are, for example, there is a Pakistan Taliban, which has really kind of sprung up over the last couple of years, where they've kind of united into a military force. And when they're run by a different guy than Mullah Omar, who's running the Afghan Taliban.
General McChrystal said last week that, talking about the changes that he thinks were appropriate and kind of giving a little prelude to this report that he's submitting, that he says the supply of fighters in the Afghan insurgency, to quote him, essentially endless. That's a pretty daunting task when you think about the fact that the enemy has no limit to the number of people they can throw at you.
Well, that's right. And in this respect, the war, it's very similar to the war in Vietnam. And there's only two ways out of this. One is you build up, in a sense, the Afghan population is endless too. I mean, you build up the capacity of the Afghans to permanently defend themselves. That's one answer. And the other answer is the reason why the enemy is endless is because, you know, as long as they have a sanctuary where they can go back and rearm and refit and, you know, they're going to keep coming back. And that sanctuary is in Pakistan. You can't win this war unless the Pakistanis, in a sense, demobilize. They have to destroy al-Qaeda, and they have to demobilize the Pakistan Taliban. If that doesn't happen, the war never ends. But here's the deal is the Pakistanis are not going to do that unless they believe that we are serious of sticking out in Afghanistan, and we're not going to walk away like we did, you know, at the last time we walked away from Afghanistan. Because the Pakistanis said, look, we're going to be the ones left in this neighborhood, and we're going to be left holding the bag. So they are very much looking at what the Americans are doing. They're not going to seriously take on the Pakistan Taliban unless they believe the Americans are going to seriously, you know, take on the Afghan Taliban.
Dr. James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation is my guest on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We're talking about General Stanley McChrystal's report on Afghanistan delivered to military officials, and the president said to be reviewing it throughout the rest of this week and into Labor Day weekend as he heads to Camp David. We'll talk more with Dr. Carafano when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose.
The latest from the Federal Security Spotlight brought to you by Cisco.
Before you buy new technology to fix a cybersecurity hole, it might be a good idea to review your processes and procedures first. Here's John Bumgarner, Research Director for Security Technology at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit.
The basics of security is where everyone falls down on. Everyone wants to buy technology. While technology is a great enabler for security, it is not the first thing you should do. The first thing you should do is stick to the basics.
To hear the entire show, log on to Federal News Radio.com. Will the top-of-mind security issues of today be the issues facing government tomorrow? Get the latest from federal experts on FISMA reform, the cyber initiative, how government is combating botnets, spyware, and other cyber evils, and more. Listen to Federal Security Spotlight, sponsored by Cisco, airing Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. or on demand at federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Security Spotlight is brought to you by Cisco, the leader in federal IT security.
Thank you for calling Rosetta Stone for your free language learning demo CD-ROM.
Yeah, what's the catch?
Excuse me?
Your ad says I can get a free Rosetta Stone demo CD. So what's the catch?
No catch. We're so sure Rosetta Stone is the fastest, easiest way to learn a new language that we'll give you a free demo CD to try it for yourself.
Okay, but I've tried to learn a new language before and it was always too hard.
Well, Rosetta Stone is a completely natural way to learn a new language, just like you learned your first language. No tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. It even comes in over 30 languages. Oh, but there is one thing.
The catch, right?
You could start speaking a new language in less than 10 minutes.
Aha! Uh-huh. Wait, did you say 10 minutes?
To get your free demo CD from Rosetta Stone, call now, 1-800-300-6912. Experience for yourself the fastest, easiest way to learn a new language guaranteed. For your free demo CD, call now, 1-800-300-6912. That's 1-800-300-6912.
I'm Amy Morris with a preview of today's Daily Debrief. We're going to be talking to the Sunlight Foundation about the Supreme Court's website. They've used crowdsourcing to help revamp their site. We'll talk with Washington attorney David Fortney about E-Verify. A recent court ruling requires contractors certify workers' employment eligibility. So what does that mean for your agency? All that and more to come on this afternoon's Daily Debrief from 3 until 7 right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. For all the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
Attention integrators, VARs, program managers, sales and marketing professionals, CEOs who need to understand how to get your products in front of the right government decision makers. This is Amtower. For the last 25 years, I've focused on only one market, doing business with our favorite rich uncle. I've learned a lot in that time, and I share that information the way I get it, unedited from the front lines with that patented Amtower edge. If you want the straight scoop, the unvarnished truth, tune in Monday at noon for Amtower Off-Center.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, talking to Dr. James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation, author of Private Sector Public Wars, Contracting in Combat, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Future Conflicts, and a West Point grad and former assistant professor there. And in that light, Dr. Carafano, thank you for your service to our country. As one of the things we were talking about before the break, we were talking about the resources that may be required to go to Afghanistan. Do you have a sense that the arsenal that we have now is going to be sufficient for what General McChrystal wants to do, execute there? Or are we going to have to rethink the stuff that we send over there?
A couple of things. You know, first of all, just the boots on the ground, the troop level. I think most people think they're going to need more troops. There's really only one place that comes from, and that is decreasing the rotation, the troop levels in Iraq that allow you to raise the troop levels in Afghanistan. Basically, instead of sending people to Iraq, you have to send them to Afghanistan. It'll bring troop levels up, probably not quite where it was at the height of the Iraq war, but certainly a lot higher than they are in Afghanistan now. Then the second thing is there's a civilian component to that, which is, as difficult it was to rebuild Iraq, Afghanistan's a much, much harder problem. Very much more backward country, and you're going to need a lot more civilian resources there, and you're putting civilians in some very austere and very dangerous environments. You're going to need a lot more military to protect and support them. That even drives your military requirement up even higher. People often talk about soft power. We need more soft power. And what they always forget to mention is, oh, yeah, by the way, in a war zone, you have to have a heck of a lot more hard power to protect your soft power. One of the reasons why contracting costs, went out of sight in Iraq was we had to hire contractors to protect the contractors, to just provide security. I mean, security costs grew exponentially because we were trying to rebuild the country in the middle of a war. And then there are some military capabilities that we don't have that you probably need in Afghanistan. For example, the kind of air support you really need is a small fixed-wing aircraft. Actually, the kind of stuff we used in Vietnam, F-16s and F-22s are not the best thing for that. So, and there's some other unique type equipment. So we're going to have to do some of the rapid acquisition things we did, like when we put heavily up armored vehicles in Iraq. So, and it's going to be a strain on the military. There's no question for that. Increasingly, we're doing it with the supplemental. So increasingly other parts of the defense budget will have to be shifted to pay for Afghanistan. That's going to put a strain both on operations and readiness, and it's going to put an incredible strain on modernization, buying new equipment, because in a sense, all the money is going to go to pay for the war.
You mentioned the civilians that are going to be required over there, and we've got a story on federalnewsradio.com with the headline, A Civilian Surge to Afghanistan Just Starting. And the story says that administration officials have often promoted the idea of linking civilian and military tools of influence. But the general consensus seems to be, you mentioned that smart power and soft power, but the consensus seems to be it's not there and doesn't appear to be getting there anytime soon.
Well, that's true. Again, you need a lot of hard power to protect the soft power.
Mm-hmm.
And, we learned a lot of lessons in Iraq. How do you recruit people? How do you pay them? How do you take care of them? We've got lessons and lessons and lessons of all the things about what you really need to do to sustain a civilian workforce in a combat zone. We haven't had time to build any of that infrastructure. So, we know how and why we're totally screwed up, but the personnel rules, the personnel system, the training, all that's going to have to be done on the fly, just like it was in Iraq, because we haven't had time to fix any of those problems.
I want to go back briefly to wrap up with to the comment that General McChrystal made about the number of fighters in the insurgency in Afghanistan being essentially endless. Secretary Gates has been reluctant to name a number of troops that he would like to send over there. Do you think that one has something to do with the other, or do you think that's a good strategy on the Secretary's part to not attach a specific number? Kind of we'll know it when we see it?
Yeah, that's a disaster. I'm telling you, that's exactly what we did in Vietnam. It was, well, how many troops do you need? Well, a lot. Well, we'll give you some, and then if you need more, we'll give you more. That's called the incremental approach. And what happens is when the enemy has, you know, a lot of forces, they just adjust incrementally what you do. This kind of go tit for tat until we can get by with just enough. That is what led us to failure in Vietnam, and it's a strategy that we should not repeat. The reason why we did so well in Iraq, and let's not forget, there were an infinite number of insurgents in Iraq. There were Sunni, Shia, Kurds, Al-Qaeda coming in. I mean, there was overwhelming, and that went away because we got ahead of the problem, because we surged forces, and in a sense, we leapfrogged ahead of the enemy. We reacted faster than they could, and they couldn't respond quick enough to do that. So if we adopt a strategy where we overwhelmingly go in, and we go in hard, and we stay hard, and do it for a couple of years, that the enemy's not going to be able to adjust. The Pakistanis will take us seriously. They'll do their job, and we'll win. But if we go in with the Johnson approach, which is, well, we'll throw a few more thousand in this year and a few more thousand in next year, you know, we'll just try to keep it quiet, keep it out of the news, not, you know, maybe Americans will care about it, things will just get worse and worse and worse, and we'll fail.
As you talk about it in that context, it makes me think that one of the reasons that that strategy would be successful is that we have better things like supply chains and so forth that might seem mundane to somebody looking from the outside, but to folks who pay attention to what's going on the inside, might make a little bit more sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of issues about sustaining forces there. You know, for example, we're heavily dependent on the Pakistanis. I mean, there's no other option. The Pakistanis cut us off, then there's no supply chain in there, right? The Russians are offering us a thing, but, you know, the last thing you want to do is be dependent on the Russians. So, getting a lot of forces in there, even if you had the will and commitment, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to sustain them, and it's going to be expensive. You know, but people have to remember, look at the alternative. You know, we're here because we walked away from Afghanistan the last time. 9/11 happened. If we walk away from Afghanistan this time, the Taliban will be back, Al-Qaeda will be back, there'll be another 9/11. If we walk away from Afghanistan this time, the Pakistani government may fall, you may see a war between India and Pakistan, you may see China involved, and now you're talking about India and China, two of the most important economies in the world today, being disrupted. I mean, this may be a terrible, awful situation. You know, the president, he may not get reelected if he sticks it out and fights this war the way it needs to be fought. But the alternatives are a heck of a lot worse. And, you know, people should remember Vietnam. You know, we walked away in Vietnam. People said, well, what's the big deal? Well, you know, people forget that the world got a lot safer or a lot less safe. The world was a lot more dangerous after we walked away in Vietnam because the Soviets thought we were on the ropes. We had insurgencies all over Africa. We had insurgencies in our own backyard in Latin America. The U.S.-Soviet relations deteriorated, and it wasn't until Ronald Reagan came aboard and in a sense turned the tide on the Cold War. But we were in tough, tough shape in the 70s. People talked in the 70s about the end of American power, and that was a directly result of our weakness in running away and losing a winnable war in Vietnam. And if we do it here, we will rue the day.
So it's fair to say it's troubling to you to see folks like George Will writing today that now's the time to get out of Afghanistan.
It's just because what they tell you is exactly what they said in Vietnam. They don't talk about the consequences of running away. And people say, well, the Vietnamese are our friends today. Well, that's true. But, you know, people forget the history of the 1970s when American power was really at its nadir and the Russians were on the march and, you know, they were sponsoring insurgencies all over the world. I mean, do people really want to let Al-Qaeda get back into the game? You know, that is, as we come up on the anniversary of 9/11, the last thing people should be doing is talking about, let's give Al-Qaeda, a second bat.